businesses have a responsibility throughout their entire value chains to respect human rights. If you can apply pressure at the top of the supply chain strategically, then you can achieve change at the bottom.
You are listening to Radio Atticus,
your national program on the law in the name of social justice.
This is obviously a live issue, and we need to start to talk about how we might regulate it here that we aren't outsourcing our problems.
People are curious. They look at you and they want to know your story.
Radio Atticus, more than the vibe.
Hello and welcome to your national program on the law and justice and how it impacts your daily lives. Anna Marie Reyes.
Hi, I'm Sophia Carvajal. I'm joining Anna Marie on your favourite legal broadcast.
With Iraqi forces retaking the Al Nuri Mosque in the old city of Mosul this week, the Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi declared the liberation of the site as the end of the statelet of ISIS, which pretty much wraps up the 8-month-long battle for Mosul. But what is the future for Iraq after ISIS? The story certainly does not end here with the liberation of Mosul. With ISIS controlling Mosul for over 3 years from June 2014, the legacy of ISIS can never be forgotten and the damage done is huge. But attention can now turn to the prospect of justice for survivors of ISIS abuses and also the need for reconciliation in Iraq. With Iraq now clearly divided along sectarian lines, with a Shia-led government in Baghdad, Sunni communities in the north who are largely displaced to the camps now, and the Iraqi Kurds wanting to break away, prospects of Iraqi unity seem unlikely. The Iraqi Kurdistan president, Masoud Barzani, has already declared a referendum to be held in September on the issue of Kurdish independence, saying it's time for the people of Iraqi Kurdistan to decide whether they want to remain as part of Iraq or not. He cited the inability of the Iraqi government to protect Kurdistan back in 2014 when ISIS attacked with advanced US weapons abandoned by the Iraqi army in Mosul as a reason to break away. He also cited the refusal of the Iraq government to provide weapons to the Kurdish Peshmerga or their share of the federal budget as reasons for an independent Iraqi Kurdistan. In states where there have been atrocities, such as Rwanda, the former Yugoslavia, or East Timor, formal truth and reconciliation processes were critical to the rebuilding of societies. Bilkis Vile, senior Iraq researcher at Human Rights Watch, points to a lack of political will internally within Iraq as one of the main obstacles for future reconciliation. I spoke to Ville after her event in Sydney last week.
The battle for Mosul is in the very last stages now. How long do you see this, the final battle? How long do you see it like playing out for?
I think it's hard to predict. You know, the Iraqi military has been putting out deadlines for the operation to be over for months now. And I do think we have to acknowledge that the old city is going to be the hardest part of the fight. It's going to be the longest. ISIS is at this point completely encircled and completely entrenched, which means they're going to fight the hardest. And so I think it is more than a matter of a week or a few weeks, and it might even be months. But hopefully at the same time, many of the civilians will be able to flee. And with that, if a lot of the civilians do get out, then on the military side, they'll be able to engage more aggressively with ISIS.
So is this the end of the conflict or do you see it continuing?
There are still different towns, desert areas where I think ISIS is either fully in control or has a lot of autonomy to move around. And for the Iraqi forces, I think it's going to be a while before they've pushed out ISIS from those areas. However, we're already seeing signs that in areas that ISIS has lost the territorial control, they have morphed very effectively back into being sort of a more traditional terrorist insurgent group and are carrying out bombings in places like Tikrit, in Ramadi, in Fallujah, in Baghdad. And so I think, unfortunately, we're definitely not going to see the end of ISIS as ISIS anytime soon.
So with the conflict perhaps winding down a little, we can now look towards justice and the possibility of justice for the victims of ISIS atrocities. How do you see that process playing out?
Unfortunately, what I have not seen, either in Baghdad or within Erbil with the Kurdistan regional government, is any real political will to push forward a justice initiative to allow victims of ISIS abuse to have access to justice. And instead, what I've seen is a very practical approach to try and detain and give the death sentence or life imprisonment to ISIS fighters as quickly as possible, which means that they are not examining what individual fighters may have done when they were parts of ISIS, simply are charging them instead with being affiliated with ISIS, which means that the victims of a specific abuse, a massacre, having been held as a sex slave, those people will never be getting justice for that specific abuse.
And what's the role of the international community and the role of bodies like the UN in the process of justice?
The UN and a coalition of international states, mostly led by the UK government, have been very public in calling for justice initiatives that would allow victims of ISIS, particularly the Yazidi community, to have access to justice. However, the big stumbling block has been that for the Iraqi authorities, they think that the death sentence is what every ISIS fighter should be getting. And that has been a real barrier in terms of the international community and the UN as an institution to back any justice initiatives that the Iraqi forces are leading on.
Yeah, so you see it as an internal process. Is that right?
You know, while there have been calls for international processes for justice, for example, the creation of a special tribunal, an international tribunal, to allow victims of ISIS access to justice, the Iraqi government view, and I've heard this from multiple ministers in Baghdad, is that this is an Iraqi process. These are Iraqi victims, and the processes need to stay in Iraq. And so I think they have been fighting tooth and nail against any international initiatives that would mean that these cases would leave the Iraqi criminal system. And so unfortunately, without buy-in by the Iraqi authorities for an international process, that's just not going to happen.
I traveled all along the front lines the past 6 months. What I saw was just the destruction. And a lot of the destruction was from the airstrikes. Is there going to be any accountability? Are the US and the coalition going to be held accountable for all this destruction that caused?
Since the campaign by the Americans when they first came into Iraq in 2003 and then in subsequent operations in countries like Afghanistan, there was a lot of work done in Washington to create mechanisms to allow for compensation, which is the way that accountability has really been conceived of, which is compensation for people who lost family members, compensation for people who lost homes. And what's been really striking is that with this coalition and the fight since 2014, there has been practically no compensation. There is no public mechanism that an individual Iraqi knows how to access in order to petition for compensation. And in fact, since 2014 and this coalition's bombing campaign, we have only seen two instances of compensation, both by the U.S. government. One was about a shooting at a checkpoint, so nothing related to the airstrikes. And when we push now in Washington for compensation, it seems to really be not a priority and not really even part of the discussion, which is extremely disappointing, and which means that I don't see Iraqi families being able to push for accountability for any of the damage or abuses by the coalition.
So Australia is an active member of the coalition. They're typically very secretive about what they do. They're not transparent. Do you have any idea exactly what role they're playing in the coalition's campaign?
You know, in this coalition, there are some states that are quite transparent and some states that are less transparent. The U.S. has been quite transparent. They put out regular reporting of what airstrikes they've participated in and whether those have led to civilian casualties, and then subsequently how they've investigated whether there was an unlawful attack. The U.K. government has been also quite transparent. And Australia really stands out as one of the least transparent members of the coalition. And in that context, for months, we have been pushing for more information around what airstrikes they participate in, whether those airstrikes have led to civilian casualties, and we've gotten really zero information. Finally, on May 2nd, after a lot of advocacy being done in this area, the government announced that they would start putting out fortnightly reports that would make public what airstrikes the Australian authorities have been participating in. We saw the first report come out on May 2nd. That report is a step in the right direction, but was very limited in the information that it made public. And it did not speak once about the casualties from the airstrikes that it carried out. And so I think the Australian government, while it's moving in the right direction, needs to be pushed much harder to be more transparent.
I'm Vanessa Powell, and that was Bilkis Vile, Senior Iraq Researcher at Human Rights Watch, and ending that report there.
You're listening to Radio Atticus, broadcast nationally to the Community Radio Network and produced in the studios of Radio 2SER. I'm Anne-Marie Reyes.
And Sophia Carvajal.
Well, I'm Gillian Triggs, and for legal news, facts and opinion, listen to Radio Atticus.
What have you always wondered about Sydney and the people who call it home? 2SER is Seeking Sydney. Head over to 2SER.com and ask the questions you want our team to investigate. While you're there, why not vote for whichever question you'd like answered? 2SER 107.3. Stories, ideas, music.
These school holidays bring your creative kids along to one of Australia's longest-running festivals for children, the Way Out West Festival at Casula Powerhouse, Liverpool, from the 12th to the 15th of July. Celebrating imagination, spontaneity, creativity and storytelling, the festival explores the art of play for the child inside and the child beside you. Tickets are on sale now at wayoutwestfestival.com.au. Casula Powerhouse, Liverpool, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
UTS Haverfield Club offers great quality food with terrific views and is just a short trip from the city. Open every day, your Sunday long lunch is soundtracked by the Sunday Sessions live musicians, making UTS Haverfield Club's dining experience one to truly savour. Whatever the occasion, you'll be inspired by the delicious menu and the superb location on Iron Cove Bay. Visit utshaverfield.com.au for info and bookings. Sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
So what's happening this week?
Have you ever seen laser beams in the sky?
What were you thinking?
I find an opportunity to lick Richard Wilkins.
Okay. Interviews and discussions and all sorts of interesting things. 107.3.
2SER.
Well, I just got back to Sydney after spending the last 18 months or so teaching English in Erbil, the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan region.
You were working as a teacher as well.
Yeah, I was teaching English as well for most of my time there.
So is it like in the news where you see just a devastating picture? What was it like day to day?
No, it's quite different from the impression that most people have from watching the news. So my day-to-day life there was quite normal. The area that I was in was quite safe, but it was only when this operation to take back Mosul began in October that things got really bad. The town that I was living in, Erbil, well, it's a city, it's actually quite a militarized city. So we had the coalition air base right next to the airport, which was in the suburb next door to where I was living. So I had the coalition base right next to me. Most of my friends were connected to the military in some way, so you can't really live there and not know people that are connected to the military, either the coalition, the Kurdish Peshmerga, the Iraqi special forces.
With that extreme swing to from one side to the other, you were talking about before that in our conversation outside the studio, you were saying that there is some trouble, everything from getting access to water for a bath to actually stepping on a landmine, and it seems to swing, like I said, from one extreme to the other.
There was a problem with utilities, like our service provision was not the best because it's a developing country. I guess the thing for me was the constant militarization and being surrounded by violence and... But it's more
Was there anything specifically because you were a woman as well, or a female, which is harder?
I don't know. I guess things like in Australia, we're not used to seeing guns. We're not used to seeing weapons. But within Kurdistan, that's quite a common occurrence to see people carrying guns and weapons.
It must be a culture shock too.
Yeah. So most of my friends carry weapons, which I find quite confronting because I'm a pacifist.
Like most of us.
Yeah. Yes.
Your talent that you interviewed from Human Rights Watch mentioned something about Sunni and Shia. Are they like two camps of people that believe in Islam?
Islam, yeah. Okay. So it's like two denominations of Islam. So we have the Sunnis and we have the Shias. And it's just two different branches of Islam. There's not that much difference between them. There's a few minor differences in the doctrine. The way they pray is different. So Sunnis will pray with their arms crossed, whereas Shia will pray with their arms by their side. That's just one difference.
How would you describe their relationship?
Historically, this is like conflict between the two different sects of Islam, and especially in Iraq. Iraq is a country pretty much divided along
religion.
I think when you look at the text, not really that much difference.
Yes, because when I was there a long time ago as a reporter for a big media network, there seemed to be an attempt with a lot of the citizens to accommodate each other's religion in the same way that, for example, in the West, we accommodate people that are Anglican background, uniting Protestants or Catholics. My impression, I guess, is becoming worse.
Iraq has many different religious minorities living within its borders. So there's Christian communities, there's Mandeans, there's Jewish communities. A very small group of Jews remain in Iraq, I think. And historically, I think they've all lived together in relative harmony and in peace. 2014, when ISIS came through, was when there were a lot of atrocities committed.
Especially against the women, the Yazidi women.
Yazidi women.
Which is indigenous religion. I remember that was really happening then. And that also has gotten worse. So in your view then, is it worth the Western world getting embroiled with what's happening there now?
Yeah, I think so. Because a lot of this, the current conflict, is a direct result of what happened in 2003. The coalition invasion of Iraq.
Yeah, when they came in and said there's weapons of mass destruction, but there's none. So you think that it's related to that? And
oh, absolutely.
And there was a mention of the Peshmergas. Can you give us a bit of an explanation? Who are they and in what context was she raising the Peshmergas?
Okay, so the Kurdish Peshmerga, they're like the government forces, the Kurdish government forces. So Iraqi Kurdistan is currently autonomous. They're an autonomous region. They have their own government and they run the region pretty much autonomously. So the Kurdish Peshmerga are the government forces for Iraqi Kurdistan.
And so when you say the regaining of Mosul, who's regaining Mosul and why?
So the first stage of the operation was by the Kurdish Peshmerga. The Kurdish government forces were sent in to regain some territory. The territory that they regained has now been incorporated into the borders of Iraqi Kurdistan and is under Kurdish control.
And so they're regaining it from ISIS?
Yes. So there was an agreement about what areas they could go into and regain.
You're listening to Radio Atticus, broadcast nationally through the Community Radio Network and produced in the studios of Radio 2 SER.
Jury duty. It's our civic duty that most people don't want to do. I talked to office worker Karen O'Neill about her attempt to get out of it, followed by Sheriff of New South Wales Tracy Hall about why we should comply with our civic duties.
Yeah, jury duty.
I suppose it's part of everyone's kind of civil duty, even though everybody tries to get out of it.
And that's what the judge said, because I tried to get out of it and, many people did try to get out of it. And as I got in the lineup to go and see the judge, he was roasting people before me, and I was thinking, oh no, my excuse isn't going to be good enough. He's going to hammer me. But I was very polite, and he was very nice to me, but he said, unfortunately, I cannot dismiss you. No. Mm-hmm. And I did get a bit rattled because, you know, they really do stare you down. And I was telling, you know, why I was essential to the office and minimal support staff, you know, and also, you know, a story about the spokes of the wheel that, you know, when the wheel keeps turning, but with some of the spokes, it doesn't turn as well, missing some of the spokes. But yes, I was a bit anxious, and I think you could see that I was a bit rattled, but no.
Here's New South Wales Sheriff Tracy Hall on why it's so important to attend.
Look, jury service plays a central role in our justice system. It's a civic duty, and it allows members of our community to play an active role in the administration of justice. Juries are used in New South Wales District Courts and Supreme Courts to hear and determine the more serious criminal matters, hear and determine civil matters involving the large monetary claims, and they can also be used in coronial inquests.
How are people chosen for jury duty? Is it alphabetically? Is it totally random?
Oh, it's totally a random selection. There's an algorithm built into the new jury management system that we have, and that is a selection of people from a jury pool area.
So what are the fines in New South Wales for failure to attend?
There is a fine of $2,200 if you fail to attend without a reasonable excuse. If that fine is continued, it will be sent to the State Debt Recovery Office where they will recover the funds. You can ask to have that fine waived if you've got a reasonable excuse and can support that with some documentary evidence.
Okay, and for those people who can't go for any reason, can they apply to be excused?
If they can, there's a number of reasons to be excused from jury service that are in the Act, in the Jury Amendment Act, and you have to have good cause to be excused. And that can be, some of the reasons can be if you've under undue hardship or serious inconvenience to you or your family or public by attending, if you have a disability that makes it unsuitable or you're incapable of effectively serving as a juror. That if there's conflict of interest or some other knowledge or acquaintance or friendship that you may have which may result in you being perceived as lacking some impartiality as a juror. The sheriff can also consider excusing you in circumstances as if you are a sole trader or a contractor, and if you have carer responsibilities. And if you're unable to read and understand English, there are other provisions, but they are the ones that are generally applied.
Here's Karen again on what actually happens in court.
When you go into the court, there's about 200 of you all in a pool. And then whenever a case is ready to pick a jury, they take about 40 of you and put you in that room. And then they ask, you know, go through a lot of a rigmarole, and then they basically just randomly pick 12. And then, of course, the prosecution can then challenge any of those potential jurors and get rid of them and then get new ones. Fortunately, I wasn't one of the random people. And when they did the one challenge, there was only one challenge. I wasn't picked to replace that one. So that was a really good bonus. Then you go back to the pool room to see if any more cases come about. And fortunately, no more cases came about, so we were all dismissed. But it takes a bit of time, though.
How long does it take? How long did it take?
Look, you can be there. That's what they said right from the word beginning. You can be there for half a day. You can be there for a full day. It really depends because, you know, they're all there busy, but until they go to trial, the jurors aren't picked. So they might be in the courts meeting each party, but until they're ready to go to trial, which could be at any time, the juries aren't called in, but they've got to have jury ready to go in, if you know what I mean.
Do they pay you for that?
Yeah, they do. Like, it's like minimum pay. It's like $100 or something like that. Couldn't do it full time. You couldn't be a full time jury member.
Here's the Sheriff of New South Wales, Tracy Hall.
So if you are selected as a juror, you will be paid an allowance. Now, this is not intended. The payment is intended to reduce your any financial hardship you may incur as being a juror. However, it's not intended to be equal or to your normal wage or salary. Today, the current daily rate for jurors between trials for 1 day to 10 days is $106.30 for all jurors. But if the trial goes from day 11 and onwards to the end of the trial, jurors who are employed will be paid a sum of $242.30 a day. However, if you're unemployed, you will still only get $106.30 a day.
What kind of questions do they ask you to determine whether you're going to be in or out?
Well, they when you first go through, they basically tell you a bit about the case, and they ask if you know anyone. They mention everybody involved in the case. For example, a doctor's name was mentioned, and one person said, "I know that doctor." Then they asked that person. They got the person to go up to see the judge to verify whether she really did know that person, the doctor, you know, full name and details. And then the judge deemed that it was, in actual fact, the same person, and so that she was dismissed. But she hasn't. When she was dismissed, she didn't just then have to go and go home. She went back to the pool room. So it's not like you're dismissed and that's your job done. You have to go back to the pool room until they officially release you. You're either on trial as a witness or you're back to the pool room until they release everyone.
Because the cases that you had, either a sexual-based assault or murder.
Yes. No, there's no murder in the one that I went through. Oh. They were all living there, but it was definitely, of the other nature, yes.
I would actually rather go to a case with murder rather than sexual assault, because the one that I went to was to do years ago was to do with incest between a father and daughter, and she was very, very emotional. It was really, it just affected me.
I think there probably would be crying in this one because obviously, because of the nature of what it was, but we heard all about the crime and in detail about the crimes, but I'm sure it would have been even more detailed if you were basically picked as one of the jury members. You know, once you get picked as a jury member, because once one jury member says, "Oh, I really can't do this, I've got another commitment," or something like that, they have to dismiss the whole jury and they have to go through the process again.
That's why the wheels of the justice system they just go so slowly because of those things like that.
And that's exactly what they said. They have to then drag in, many, many, another couple of hundred people in just to fill this jury again.
There is one other thing about the jury service that I would like to emphasise for your listeners, and that is that the jury service has recently undergone a huge transformation with new technology, which has allowed us to provide a more efficient way in which we operate and causes less burden on the life of a juror or potential jurors and their employers.
That's great. Could you give us a few examples about the new technology being used?
Certainly. Look, we've brought the jury service into the 21st century because we can offer secure online profiles which jurors can access any time during the day or night, with an option to opt into text and email notifications and receive payments electronically. We're also able to process the attending jurors much more quickly when they come into court on the day for their summons, which means that if they're not required for trial or required to be excused on that day, we can return them to their daily activities without wasting a significant amount of their day. So whilst we understand jury service can be an inconvenience on people's lives, it's also necessary to ensure our jury system is fair and transparent, and this new system allows us to make the jury journey a lot quicker and a lot more efficient.
That was the New South Wales Sheriff Tracy Hall and Karen O'Neill, office worker, talking about being summoned for jury duty.
2SER 107.3,
and this week we're probing the dark recesses of the mind.
Oogum boogum.
Very scary.
Did you wet yourself?
It could happen to you.
Stick around even if that scene does disturb you too much.
You're listening to 2SER on 107.3.
Interesting, obscure stuff.
Stories. Ideas. Music. 2SER 107.3.
I'm Michael Kirby, and you are listening to Radio Atticus. Radio Atticus is part of the Community Radio Network. I was formerly a Justice of the High Court of Australia with no time to listen to this, but now I sit glued to Radio Atticus.
A shout out to all our listeners around the country, to Bob FM in Taree, New South Wales, 7RPH in Hobart, Tasmania, 8CCC in Alice Springs, 4NSA at Noosa Heads in Queensland, and more. Thank you for your ongoing support. Radio Atticus has been with you since 2009, and we continue to power on because of you. The content you hear on Radio Atticus is not legal advice. If you need legal advice, please contact your independent legal advisor.
And that's about all we have time for in this edition. We hope you enjoy the show.
Radio Atticus is broadcast nationally to the Community Radio Network and produced in the studios of Radio 2SER.
If you want more, why not tune into our podcast on www.2ser.com/Radio Atticus.
Tune in again next week at the same time and place for your regular dose of justice and the law here on Radio Atticus. I'm Anna Marie Reyes.
And I'm Sophia Carvajal.